All right.
I think we're on here.
Blogging Heads. I am Tim Noah of Slate Magazine. And with me is Jonathan Cohn, Dean of the Healthcare Writers at the New Republic Magazine. I too have been covering healthcare, not as long as John, but I've been covering it at Slate, the healthcare reform bill, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Welcome, John.
Thank you. And yes, you've not been covering healthcare as long as I have, but you've been covering Washington far longer, which is a key fact to keep in mind as we proceed with this discussion of what may or may not be happening in Washington. So
I am here in D.C. and are you in Michigan?
I am back in Michigan. I was in Washington last week, but I'm back in balmy, sunny Michigan.
I myself was in Michigan actually last week, debating not one but two opponents of healthcare reform at Grand Valley State University. They had a debate with a guy from Cato and a guy from AEI and me. It was an ambush.
But
I did really well. I think I won.
I'm sure you held your own, more than held your own.
One of the sad things was they told me that they had a really hard time finding somebody to argue the pro-health reform side, which I thought was a sad comment. They were talking to all these think tank people, and finally they decided to settle for a lowly journalist because none of the think tank people were willing to come out and defend healthcare reform. I find that a little bit disturbing.
I find that extremely disturbing. Although I actually think that speaks to one of the broader, not to jump ahead in our discussion, but why did we get to this place where it's on such shaky ground? Or maybe even not even on shaking ground, I think there is this mismatch of intensity. You have the people who are in favor of healthcare reform broadly, but all of them, and I would include us in this category, both because I think of our general temperament. We tend to be, a lot of us are journalists, we're fairly, I would like to think, we're very intellectually honest. So we can see the warts on the bills, we see the flaws in the bills moving through, and we tend to talk about them. And even apart from that, I think there is a sense that, well, this isn't everything we want it to be. It's not even close to everything we want it to be. So there's a lot of ambivalence among the would-be supporters. Of course, the opponents, they hate it, and they hate everything about it. And so you get this mismatch of intensity. So inevitably you get these conversations where it's hard, or you get an instance like you're talking about. It's easy to find people who will come, 100% out against these bills. It's hard to find people who will come out, even 75% for these bills. And so I think that's part of the problem.
And I was struck by the fact that I'm struck by this again and again, all the opponents had to say was Washington can't do anything, and they brought the house down. I had to sort of keep interjecting. Well, actually, Washington, can do things, has been doing many things for years, and tends to run healthcare policy more efficiently than the private sector, for example, which I know is something you've written quite a bit about.
Absolutely. There's this great irony. We've seen how many times in this debate we've had the supposed opponents of government run healthcare, arguing that we can't have healthcare reform because it will change Medicare, which of course is a government-run policy. And as you know, talk to any expert out there who's really taken the time to look at the healthcare system and say what is the best system out there or one of the best systems, and you always hear about the Veterans Administration, which is actually socialized medicine. I mean, no one's talking about creating a socialized medicine system in this country, but if you wanted to, it would look exactly like the Veterans Administration, which is, on balance, one of the best systems out there. So it is.
And
this
would be a good occasion. You're providing a good occasion to plug my friend Philip Longman's wonderful book, Best Care Anywhere, which is a book length examination of how the Veterans Administration managed to bound ahead of the private sector, especially when it came to use of electronic record keeping.
That it is an incredible book, and I always sort of tell people about that book. You should read that book even if you don't care about healthcare. Just to speak to the broader point you are talking about, which is, you know, if you think the government can't do anything right and the private sector is always superior, well, read that book and explain it then, because that book, I think, makes an incredibly compelling case that here the government did something not just right, but very, very right, and the private sector is, frankly, in a catch-up mode. And you actually, and you do see that elsewhere in the healthcare system. I mean, people forget, but, you know, the system, I don't want to get too wonky here, but the system that Medicare currently uses for paying hospitals. Now, it's somewhat outdated at this point, but when it was invented in the 1980s, it's called Diagnostic Research Groups, or Related Groups, DRGs. It was a very innovative way of paying for medical care, and people from all over the world have now copied it, and that was invented by Medicare. So actually, the public sector and health government is actually fairly innovative. I know that sounds like...
And the conservative argument, also, one point I made at this debate, the conservative argument tends to be self-contradictory. It's like the old joke about, the food at this restaurant is lousy and such small portions. You'll hear conservatives on the one hand saying, this will lead to rationing, and on the other hand, you'll hear them saying, you know, government spending has no discipline whatsoever. And they're not at all bashful about making both of these contradictory arguments at the same time.
They're not, and I, like I said, I think that was my dig earlier about, I don't know if it was a dig or my statement, that I think some of us on the left, we try very hard to be intellectually honest and grapple with these issues. It's stunning to me how few people on the right are willing to face up to these contradictions, and they just, you know, it's a good talking point. They understand the politics. They understand that, you know, what's the easiest way to defeat healthcare? One of the easiest ways to defeat healthcare reform is to get seniors really riled up, so they're happy to, you know, rile them up by saying, you know, we're going to protect your Medicare, even though, you know, then on the one hand they'll say that, and the other hand they'll say, oh, Medicare is a disaster. It's really, it makes arguing with them a little difficult. So I admire, I admire you what you were doing the other night.
Thank you. The great moronic rallying cry of the summer was, you know, keep government away from Medicare.
Right.
Which some people actually said. Seriously, not understanding that Medicare is government. Anyway, well, let's get started on our agenda here.
Yes.
The question is healthcare reform dead or is it not? I have tended to write that it's dead, at least for the moment. I can't peer that far into the future, but at the moment, I don't see any path towards passing this bill. You've been somewhat more optimistic. And there have been some attempts, mainly in the House, to try and keep things going. So let me ask you, John, how does this bill come back from the dead?
It's a great question. And let's put optimism in context here. I think healthcare reform can still pass. I think I certainly think it is alive. I would not pronounce it healthy. I think if you were betting, you know, you're saying, is it more likely to fail, more likely to succeed? I'd probably say it's more likely to fail at this point. The odds are against it, but I do think there is a path. I think most people at this point, one of the reasons I think it's a real path is that if you talk to people in Washington, on the Hill, in the administration, the people, the organizers, the activists, the advocates working on this, they all seem to agree that, yeah, this is what we're going to have to try to do, which is, you know, even having that much consensus is something you didn't have a week or two ago. The path is pretty simple. You got to pass the Senate bill. The House has to pass the Senate bill. And I assume most of our viewers know the background here, right? Basically the Democrats no longer have 60 votes. They have only, quote unquote, 59 votes in the Senate. And that means that they can't simply bring a compromise version of the House and Senate healthcare bills back to the Senate for one final vote. There won't be enough votes. The Republicans will filibuster. 49 senators will prevent 41 senators will prevent 59 from being able to go ahead. So there has to be some other way. The other way is basically two steps. Number one, the House passes the Senate bill as it's currently written, because the Senate's already passed it, so now the House can pass it and just send it to the President. And then the two houses together agree on a set of amendments to that, which they pass through what's known as the budget reconciliation process. And again, I assume most of our viewers at this point know what that means, but in case they've not been following this debate, the reconciliation process is invented to deal with budgetary issues, things that affect the bottom line of the government, and under reconciliation rules, 51 votes can pass a law. There's a limited time of debate. You can't filibuster. We can talk about the ins and outs of reconciliation later on. It's not as easy as you might think. There's lots of opportunities to obstruct. But at the end of the day, if you can get to the end of the reconciliation process, a simple majority, 51 votes, could pass the bill. So that's the
path. And one point I'd like to interject here, which I think hasn't been made enough, is people think that it's somehow exotic or strange to use the budget reconciliation process. Lots of bills have passed this way, most notably the welfare reform bill. The Reagan tax cuts, I think, also passed, the first one anyway, passed through reconciliation, even though its effect on the budget was not to reduce the deficit, which is supposed to be an objective, I think, of reconciliation, but to vastly expand it. Let me ask you this, though, John. Here's where I get stuck in all of these scenarios. I understand that the House Liberal Democrats, who have problems with parts of the Senate bill concerning the tax on expensive health insurance policies, the so-called Cadillac tax. They have trouble with a provision that doesn't allow immigrants to buy health insurance on the new exchanges even without government subsidies. A couple of other things like that. I understand that the House Liberals can probably be brought around. In fact, the House Liberals and liberals in general have been brought around again and again and again on this bill. They have never ultimately been the problem of this bill. The problem of this bill has always been getting conservative Democrats to support it. And what I don't see how you get the conservative House Democrats to support either adopting the Senate bill outright or adopting the Senate bill with a simultaneous reconciliation bill to fix the changes, to make the changes that they want. And the reason I don't see how this would work is because possibly the biggest obstacle for the conservative House Democrats is the abortion language in the Senate, which is still opposed by the U.S. Conference of Bishops, still opposed by Bart Stupak, although he hasn't been talking about it much. And the abortion language, one of the great ironies here, is the abortion language cannot, as far as I can tell, be addressed in a reconciliation bill precisely because it has nothing to do with federal spending, even though Bart Stupak's whole argument in favor of his preferred amendment is that he's keeping in place a ban on the use of federal dollars to pay for abortions. That is a false claim, that what the Stupak Amendment does is it affects the spending of private dollars on abortion in a sort of de facto way anyway. And so then the question becomes, well, how do you get that into reconciliation if that becomes the deal? The only path I see there is you have to have a third bill. In addition to the reconciliation bill, you have to have a third standalone bill that would simply adopt the language of the Stupak Amendment. And you would have to get that standalone bill passed in the Senate, which I think would be a tall order. Then finally liberals might be the problem. And then you have to get it through the House as well. So tell me if I'm, maybe this analysis is wrong, but I just don't see how you thread this needle.
Right. Well, I don't think, I mean, it's not that the analysis is wrong. I think the landscape you have painted is correct in terms of here are the problems. I mean, I think, first of all, just to kind of walk through, say what you, I mean, I would agree that I think the liberals are not the ones to kill this in the end, and that they come around for the same reason they have all along, because they really want this for the best of reasons in a lot of cases. And as however many compromises they've had to make, and boy, they've had to make a lot, they believe in this, they want it to happen, and they realize that even a flawed bill is still such a huge accomplishment, they'll come around. So it is the moderates, it is the conservatives, and it's as you portray them, these are difficult groups to bring around. I guess why, what I would argue, and this is not just my opinion, this is based a lot on talking to people over the last week who are in the middle of this, who are dealing with the members of Congress, is that you can actually thread that needle in the following ways. First of all, when you look at the moderate Democrats in the House, I mean, there are sort of policy issues and there are political issues. The policy issue for a lot of them, if you take them seriously, if you take what they say at face value, and they're members of Congress, so I think you can, you know, it's always a mix of what we're hearing in terms of, you know, what they actually believe versus what they're saying for their constituents. But, you know, let's take it at face value for the moment. Their concern has always been that healthcare is too expensive, that it will cost too much, that it'll be too generous, and it won't be fiscally responsible enough. Well, if you look at the House bill and you look at the Senate bill is actually, it spends less money, and it has more of what most economists would consider effective cost control. Now, I happen to like the House bill a lot. I actually like the House bill better than the Senate bill. But putting that aside, if you are a blue dog Democrat, your concern with health care reform is that it's too expensive, or your anxiety about it was it's going to cost too much money, there isn't enough to really bring down costs hard. Well, then, and if you voted for the House bill in the first place, you should definitely vote for the Senate bill because the Senate bill is better as far as you're concerned. The price tag is lower. It has this tax on benefits. It has this Medicare commission that's designed to calibrate payments to bring out waste in the system. So on paper, at least, you should like this bill better if that is your concern. And for a lot of them, that's what they profess to be the concern. Now, obviously, for a lot of them, this is politics. Maybe they were willing to go along with this before the Massachusetts election, but now they're looking at the Massachusetts election. They are freaking out about the polls. A lot of them are in very marginal districts. You know, their districts are lean more conservative, and they are looking ahead, saying, well, I'm going to get hammered on this if I vote for this in November. And this is where the advocates need to make the argument that I've been making. I can't remember if you've been making this, but a lot of us have been making, which is that when you think about the political picture here, it really doesn't make sense to vote against the bill now because, right. In effect, you've paid that political price. You've already voted for a bill. And the ad that's going to run against you in November, the script is written. The script is, you know, Congressman X voted for that awful liberal government takeover of healthcare. And then the only thing that's going to change is the ending. It's either the bill that passed or the bill that almost passed. It's the same advertisement either way. No matter what, you're going to get creamed on that. Now, what is your best...
You haven't addressed abortion. The Senate bill is more conservative in virtually... In almost every way, but it is more, at least in the eyes of the bishops, quote-unquote liberal, unacceptably so, on abortion. So that's the
rub. No.
Where does that come into your analysis?
So the abortion issue, and this is the Stupak group, right? You know, Bart Stupak has sort of led this. He said he won't vote for the Senate bill because of its language. If you talk to people, again, who've been working on this, they believe in general that there are somewhere at the moment between 10 and 15 members of Congress, give or take, who voted yes on the House bill and would vote no over the abortion language. Now, the question is, can Nancy Pelosi, the House leadership, President Obama, can they either, number one, reduce that number, or number two, somehow convert people who voted no on the former bill, on the first House bill, and get them to vote yes on the second bill to basically make up that deficit.
Now, that's got to be awfully hard because, we know that Nancy Pelosi did not want the Stupak Amendment in the bill the first go-round when she had a somewhat stronger hand.
Right. Well, here's what you have to believe this, and you know you can take your again I would not say these are overwhelmingly good odds, but I don't think they're zero odds. I think they're considerably better than zero odds. Number one, you have to assume that Pelosi had a few votes in her pocket that she didn't use, so that she had the ability last time. I mean, that bill cleared by two votes or three votes, but that she had an extra five or six votes she could have gotten if she needed. Number two.
A couple liberals didn't vote for the bill.
There's a couple liberals. There's a couple of blue dogs, again, who, again, were against this. They voted against the House bill because it was too expensive. Now they're getting a bill that's less expensive. You might even assume that some of these people were planning the whole time to vote for the final bill. They wanted to vote against the first one so that when the second one came in, they could say, aha, this bill is better now. It's got more cost control. Now I can vote for it in good consciousness, So you have that. Number two, this is like the most unheralded story of last week. Almost nobody knows. The Catholic bishops put out a statement last week. And got very little coverage, but in which they said it's really important to pursue healthcare reform. Now, it was a very bland, you know, whatever kind of statement, but the significance of this coming from the bishops, I think, is that, you know, when, if you remember, if you go back to the House vote, you remember, there was all this talk about how the bishops were lobbying, but all their lobbying was about abortion. That's all they were lobbying on. And obviously a lot of members care about that. And then, frankly, they got some criticism for that because, you know, you're the Catholic bishops, you're supposed to care about social justice. You know, why aren't you also lobbying so hard to make sure that health coverage gets out there? Well, you know, now they are. And it will be interesting to see whether maybe, you know, where they come out on this, what message they start sending. I mean, I certainly took that as a sign that they realize how precarious this suddenly is. And they don't.
Oh, I'm sorry, you broke up there for a second. Who is the they that you're talking about?
The Catholic bishops. They put out a statement.
Oh, so you think there's a possibility the Catholic bishops could be brought around?
I think the message coming from them might not be the stark message it was in the first place, and that might give, you know, Pelosi, Obama, the people supporting the bill, a little room to work. And then there, you know, I don't think there's. I mean, they will have to figure out some way to fix this, and that gets tricky for exactly the reasons you said. I mean, are we really going to have liberals voting, you know, to restrict abortion language in a separate bill? Because as you said, it can't happen during reconciliation. But you know, you can see the wiggle room there, and you know, again, it sounds like a tough needle to thread. It is a tough needle to thread, but all I can tell you is that the people working on this, they know the numbers, and they think they have a shot at this. That when push comes to shove, I think, you know, if they can get within 10 votes on the House side, at the end of the day, when the President of the United States is on the phone saying, my presidency depends on this, your party's future depends on this, your reelection depends on your being able to show an accomplishment for this, rather than being able to, and you're going to get attacked no matter what you do, that at the end of the day, they have a shot, and not just a shot, you know, one in 100 shot, you know, a decent shot at getting those numbers up. It's going to be tough. I don't know anybody, like I said, who would bet that it's more likely than not to happen, but, you know, the path is there.
Mm-hmm. Well, this gives us a nice segue into our next topic, which is the demonization of politics in this whole process, which is a pet peeve of mine. The president, I think, is making a great mistake in blaming the failure of healthcare reform on evil lobbyists and on sort of terrible deal-making. The second of these I wrote a column about, and my argument was that Obama's saying, you know, I have nothing to do with those deals that created the Cornhusker kickback to Ben Nelson, where the state of Nebraska won't have to pay for the Medicaid expansion that the other states are going to have to pay for, and so on.
And he was totally oblivious. No one told him this was going on.
And first of all, it's clearly not true. Second of all, it plays into this kind of sort of virginal distaste for the way politics works. You know, a certain amount of horse trading is part of the political process. Ben Nelson wouldn't vote for health care, so you had to give him something. You had to give a state something. You're not giving it to Ben Nelson personally. That would be bribery. There was a payoff. It's not politics at its most exalted, but this is how the system works. It's how it's worked, you know, going back to the beginning. I mean, I would not be sitting today in Washington, D.C., were it not for a base political trade between the Federalists who wanted the federal government to assume state debts, and the Southerners who wanted the capital to be located on in the South. That's why Washington, D.C. is located on the Potomac. This is an old story in politics, and I don't think that the president does the process any good by pretending that it can be Simon Pure at all moments and that it can be televised nonstop on C-SPAN. I think it reflects a kind of one of the things about Obama that I don't much like, which is a kind of moral vanity. He is a very good man, and I admire him for it about 98%, but there's 2% where I think, you know, I would like to see him get his fingernails dirty a little more often.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, I mean, I agree with you completely that, you know, let's not be naive about politics. This is how it's always been. This is how you get something through Congress. You know, if you try to have a purist, we will make no deals, we will compromise with nobody, we're just, you know, nothing would ever happen in Washington. It's the way politics works. It's the way politics everywhere in the world works. It's the way it's always worked, the way it always will. I think the problem, frankly, is that there's been a messaging problem. I hate that word, messaging. It's a classic Washington word, but I suppose it's, you know, it's the right word. You know, it's not such, I think it doesn't, the level of deal making in this bill doesn't strike me as particularly out of, you know, particularly large, you know, out of proportion to what we've seen in other bills. Frankly, I think if you go through the whole process of hashing this bill out, you could actually make a case that there were fewer deals and the entire bill was put together with a sort of greater commitment to sort of policy honesty, right? I mean, look at all this time we've spent trying to satisfy the Congressional Budget Office. So, I mean, if anything, this bill is better than the average bill in that respect. But look, I mean, you know, this is what happens when you debate something over a year. People get caught up in this, and this is all we're hearing about now. And they haven't done a great job of selling what the bill really should do and will do for people. And so it seems out of character. But you know, I agree. I don't like the Cornhusker kickback, and in fact, I think that's one of the things we'll see changed if they do pass this. I think in the reconciliation path, that one of the things they'll get changes, there won't be a Cornhusker kickback anymore. I don't like the deal they made with the pharmaceutical industry.
Actually, the final outcome seems like it's a net gain for everybody, which is the feds are going to pay a larger share of Medicaid for everyone, which is terrific.
Absolutely. And actually, if I can jump back to the last question for a second, when I was ticking off the reasons why I think this might work, I had meant to include that. You know, if you're a congressman thinking about why would I now vote for this if, you know, the people are sort of turning against it. Well, one reason is what became the sort of symbol of, you know, all the corrupt deal making was this Nebraska deal. Well, now you can say, hey, wait, I'm going to vote to take out the Nebraska deal. That's a good vote. You'll be happy. You know, and you can sort of brag about that. You know, we saw that there was a problem here. You know, you need a narrative to tell your voters why you voted for this. Well, here you go. Well, look, the bill came back. We had a chance to fix what was wrong with it. And there you go. So, I mean, I actually think that's not an insignificant part of why this could work. But yes, no, on a policy grounds, getting rid of the Nebraska give back and just changing the way we pay for Medicaid overall is probably a win-win. So yeah, you know, I mean, the irony here again is that I would argue, you know, if you want to take an easy comparison, look at the process and look at the bill that we're producing now and look at the Medicare Part D, you know, the Medicare prescription drug benefit, which was pushed through by the Bush administration. I mean, you know, this bill, they've bent over backwards to, you know, make it actually pay for itself and satisfy the Congressional Budget Office. That bill had, right, you know, zero pay-fors, right? And, you know, there were tons of deals. There was a ridiculous giveaway to the insurance industry and a ridiculous giveaway.
And there was actually an actual bribe involved,
yes,
in the passage of that bill, too, which I wrote about at the time, extended by Tom DeLay. He was offering a member of Congress. He was offering to give money to his son's congressional campaign. Now that's not horse trading. That's in the private sector, and therefore we call that bribery. And he was chided for it. I think maybe he should have been prosecuted for it, but he was at least chided for it by the Ethics Committee.
Absolutely. No, and you know, and let's not forget that was a bill literally written in portion by lobbyists for the major healthcare industries. And again, you know, obviously the healthcare industry has been very involved in this effort. Again, you know, when you want to talk about corruption, you want to talk about deal making, and they're not the same thing, as I think we should distinguish between the two. I think, at least based on what I know, everything I've heard, and you tell me if you disagree, I think this bill is actually better than what we've seen in the past.
Yes, I mean, the one thing I heard you start to mention, and I interrupted you, was the deal. Actually, one deal that the White House was directly involved in, which was a deal with the pharmaceutical industry to limit what they were going to have to kick in. That actually was a deal that I did not like. I think you regarded it as a necessary evil. But it's very strange for the president to, on the one hand, cut a deal with the pharmaceutical industry, which, while it certainly has a lot of influence, doesn't have any actual votes on the Senate floor, but then to simultaneously turn his nose up on deals that got struck with actual members of the Senate.
Right, right. Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, you know, there's a clear inconsistency there. I was somewhat convinced that the drug industry deal was a necessary evil. Mostly because just they're so powerful and they have so much influence on Congress, and if they had wanted to kill this, I think they could have. But it was a terrible deal, and I think the drug industry got away. I don't want to say they got away with murder, but you know they got a real sweetheart deal out of it. But you know that's part of the process too. You know, you can at least make the argument that it's true that relative to what I would have done or what you would have done, this bill is a lot nicer to the drug industry. On the other hand, I mean, you know, there are things in this bill that will, at least over the long run, probably affect their bottom line and probably not in a positive way. You know, they are actually pretty scared about this comparative effectiveness stuff, which, you know, this idea that we're going to start studying treatments and looking at which ones actually work better and, you know, maybe paying more for the ones that work and paying less for the ones that don't. You talk to them and they're pretty freaked out about it. Now, the bill as written doesn't do a whole lot of that, but it does start to move us towards that. So, you know, again, everything is relative. In an ideal world, the pharmaceutical industry would have nothing to do with this bill, either with the hospital industry. You know, it would be, you know, we would televise, well, I don't know if I'd really want to televise all the negotiations on C-SPAN, but, you know, in general, it would be more transparent. We'd have less deal making. But, you know, good luck actually trying to get anything done in Washington. And overall, I think you'd have to put everything in perspective. And like I said, overall, I think this bill has been better, certainly, than what we saw with the Medicare drug benefit under the Bush administration, and I would argue, at least based on my knowledge, and again, I defer to you on this, I would say it's actually, for something of this size, no worse than average and possibly better than average.
Very possibly better, but let's talk about lobbyists for a second, because, you know, so the other thing that Obama's doing is demonizing the lobbyists, but the irony here is that lobbyists tend to favor this bill. In fact, one of the arguments that some version of this bill will get passed is based on the idea that this is not 1994, when you had industry lined up against Hillary Care. In 2010, you have most of the healthcare industry wanting the health reform bill. The one significant exception is the insurance industry. And even the insurance industry, while it was opposing this bill, it might be a case of be careful what you wish for, because that industry was expecting $500 billion to get passed to it as a result of this bill. Now they're not going to get it if it doesn't pass.
That's right. That's right. Well, I mean, you know, again, and this goes back, you know, if we kind of wind back the clock to two years ago, we were both writing about why we need to be talking about healthcare reform in the first place. You know, back before this debate got started officially in Congress, a big part of it was that the system is unsustainable. And at the end of the day, if a system is unsustainable, that's going to affect all the industry players. It doesn't do the hospitals any good if there aren't enough paying patients to pay the bills. Same with the doctors, same with the drug makers, same with the device makers. It doesn't do employers any good if no one is controlling healthcare costs and they're constantly in this situation where they either have to cut back their worker health benefits, which causes problems with their workforce, or they're putting more money into health benefits that they can't put into other things. So most of the industry groups, and it obviously varies depending on which group, have a stake in seeing reform go forward. So they do, and most of them in some way support this. Now, obviously, they support it in part because once the bill was done, it was done in a way that wasn't too difficult for them. And, you know, I think for all of them, they're making the calculation that I'm better off with reform than without. And so that's because of their lobbying, and that's because of, you know, we did have these deals. But it's absolutely true that I think the lobbyists for many, if not most of the groups, do want this to happen. Now, it will be interesting to see, quite honestly, as this moves forward, how hard they push. I mean, that's always been the question to some extent. It's one thing to have a group like the pharmaceutical industry saying, yeah, we support reform. Do they actually go and call their members of Congress who they give contributions to and say, please pass this bill? And I feel kind of funny saying that I want them to do that because I don't really, you know, like industry lobbying as a general rule. But, you know, if you want to sort of game this out, it will be interesting to see if they actually do that or they just sort of sit it out on the sidelines.
I guess the question would be, what's more powerful in Washington, special interests or conservative ideology?
Yeah, well, that is an interesting question. I'll tell you one interesting thing to think about. If you think about it, and I think this is particularly true with the pharmaceutical industry, because in some ways, when you think of the different groups that have been in the middle of this, they've sort of, again, even though I feel like the bill was way too nice to them, they've stuck their neck out for it more than the other groups. Remember, they did, you know, finance this huge advertising campaign. It wasn't, you know, it was very generic, it was bland, but it was, you know, $150 million of ads on the air saying we should pass healthcare reform. They have not been running ads against healthcare reform. And they've kind of stuck their necks out. And yet pharma, typically, you know, has historically had a very close relationship with the Republican Party. Are they out on an island now? I mean, if this doesn't pass and the Obama presidency is sort of, you know, handcuffed the rest of the way and the Democratic majority in Congress is handcuffed or even, you know, who knows, you know, maybe they lose the majority, pharma is going to have some, having a bit of a harder time getting its phone calls returned from the Republicans. So it will be interesting to watch and see how they, you know, where they are on this. You know, on the one hand, I think they at this point have sort of placed their bets and they want this to pass and they feel like they, you know, that's the path for them. On the other hand, like you said, I mean, all these groups, you know, and pharma is certainly among them, they're fundamentally conservative groups. You know, having the government intervene in any part of the free market is not something that's going to sit well with a lot of them. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is.
Have you by any chance spoken to Karen Ignani, who runs the pharmaceutical? Is she wandering around like a zombie saying, what have I done? What have I done?
You mean Billy Tozian from pharma or Ignani?
The insurers.
The insurers, yeah. You know, I haven't spoken to Karen Ignani recently. I did a profile on her back in the spring. And back then, I believed back then, and I even still believe to some extent that they saw their self-interest as, you know, being aligned with healthcare reform if it was done in a certain way. I frankly was surprised at how they played it. And I wonder if they're walking around like that, wondering what they've done. In part, I will tell you, because their outlook is not great if nothing happens. You know, a world where insurance keeps getting more and more expensive and no one is controlling costs, they in some ways will feel the effects of that. I mean, they don't necessarily do so well in that environment. And as you said, you know, you look at healthcare reform, however you structure it, it's a huge, you know, it's 40 million or 30, well, more like 20 million new customers. That's good for business. It's certainly good for the big insurers who would frankly probably thrive in this system. So, you know, I wonder. I haven't talked to her. It's a good thing. Maybe when we get off the phone, off this session, I'll pick up the phone and see how they're feeling about things.
Let's talk about Massachusetts because that was the one instance where the, you know, sort of politics of this were tested in laboratory conditions. But I would argue that the laboratory was a bad laboratory. Because if you look at the polls, you know, Massachusetts went for a Republican who was opposed to healthcare reform, which is why we no longer have 60 votes in the Senate for health reform. You know, sort of throughout the whole health reform debate, we've heard periodically it said by Orrin Hatch and others, if only Ted Kennedy were here, things would be different. This is one instance where if only Ted Kennedy were here, we know things really would be different. There would be that 60th vote for health care reform. But the Republican, Scott Brown, won, running against health care reform. There were no you know, truly objective exit polls, but there was an unofficial exit poll conducted by a Republican firm, and then very soon thereafter, Kaiser did a poll. And both of those polls found that this election really was a referendum on health care reform. But, and this especially came out in the Kaiser poll, it was a referendum on Obamacare, but the poll also showed that people in Massachusetts, a majority of them, support RomneyCare, their own version of Obamacare, which is, if anything, slightly more left-wing than Obamacare, even though it's the brainchild of a self-described conservative Republican candidate for president. So it was a weird kind of referendum. I think it's quite fair to interpret that election as saying, look, we've got our health care reform. We don't need this national health care reform because we have essentially the same program here in Washington. We don't want to pay taxes to give it to everybody outside of Massachusetts.
Yeah, it was hard to understand at first. And I should say, I mean, look, I lived for a very long time in Massachusetts. I have family there. My mug I've been drinking water from here is my David Ortiz 2004 World Series. I'm a huge, you know, I love Massachusetts. I think the people of Massachusetts were not, shall we say, acting in the interest of the nation as a whole, to the extent that they were doing what you were saying, they were saying, look, we have our Obamacare, we have our version, we don't want to do it nationally. I would say two things. I mean, I think to some extent, to be fair, I mean, I think what we saw was, in general, there was a negative reaction to what was happening in Washington, a sort of generalized, you know, we don't like the healthcare bill, which sort of runs into we don't like what's going on in Washington, we don't like bailing out the bankers, we don't like deficit spending. I mean, it was sort of part of a mix. And I'm always, you know, I think the polls don't always disaggregate those thoughts so well. So I think to some extent, we were seeing just a generalized anger at Washington. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, the polls have been very consistent on how people in Massachusetts feel about healthcare reform in Massachusetts. And they like it. That's not to say they never complain about it. That's not to say that it doesn't have its problems. But
support's down a little bit, I think, in the last couple of years since the recession started and also since premiums started to rise somewhat precipitously. But still, a majority supports it.
They do. And actually, if you ask the question, do you want to repeal it? I mean, it's around 11% say yes to that. I mean, it's very, very low. I don't think that's surprising. I mean, I think if you look objectively just at what reform has done, and there have been separate studies, right? You know, are people having an easier time or harder time getting access to medical care? Are their bills bigger enough? In general, the numbers show improvement, not as much improvement as I would like, but it's a clear improvement and a fairly stark improvement when you consider this has happened since the Massachusetts law came into effect. For most of the period now, we've been in a very severe economic crisis. So for people to be actually getting better access to care and having less problem with their medical bills at a time when the economy is crumbling, it's quite an accomplishment. So people like that bill. And I think, either they're not putting two and two together and not saying that, well, gee, this works for us, so why not give it to the rest of the nation? Or, as you say, they're being a little selfish. And to them, I would just say this to those who sort of feel like, well, you know, I don't want to be paying my tax money to be helping other people get health care. You know, I already paid for it. The two things I would remind them of is, number one, the bills actually give a little extra money to Massachusetts and Vermont in recognition, in part, of the fact that those two states have actually been very aggressive already in expanding health insurance. So we don't want to penalize them for that. But the other thing to remember is, you know, the Massachusetts healthcare reforms involved a huge subsidy from Washington. You know, they were able to do what they were due because Washington gave them a ton of money and gave them a waiver. You know, what we're now talking about is essentially sort of trying to replicate that around the country to sort of say, well, we have it. We don't want anyone else get it. Is honestly, if that's what people are thinking up there, I hope they're not, but maybe they are. That's pretty selfish.
And I can't let this conversation end without saying that what a truly nauseating spectacle it is to see Mitt Romney explain why Romney Care is good and Obamacare is evil. I don't know if you've seen him interviewed on this question, but he lies his head off. he really, I think, will go to presidential candidate hell for his role in this. Fortunately, he's not especially popular in Massachusetts right now, so I don't know how much influence he had on the vote directly. But, you know, he'll say, well, Obamacare is one-size-fits-all medicine, which is, of course, not true. Like the Massachusetts plan, the Obamacare plan creates an exchange where private companies compete to sell insurance to the uninsured population. He also says, we managed to do it in Massachusetts without taxes. There were taxes. The Massachusetts plan was paid for with tax revenue. There's just a lot of really nauseating misrepresentation going on.
There is, and you know, I mean, I remember this during the presidential campaign when Romney was saying this during the campaign because he was in a Republican primary and didn't want to seem too liberal, so he would routinely say, "We did a great thing in Massachusetts. Don't do it to the rest of the nation." And it was quite something to behold. But you know, if we're sort of closing out here, I mean, I do think to people thinking about politicians, members of Congress, you know, why would I vote for this given the public opinion polls? I beg them, look at Massachusetts. Take a hard look at Massachusetts because what you see there is the bill is in place, it's been passed, the system is getting underway, it is underway, and people like it. They appreciate it. That is something you can hang your hat on as a politician. You will be able to run on this. Even the federal version, which takes a longer time to roll out, it has some immediate effects, or relatively immediate effects. And I think at the end of the day, you know, to bring it back to where we started, again, I'm not optimistic this will pass. I think the odds are against it. But to the extent that I think it does have a shot, I think that's because the political logic of it is pretty compelling. And that if politicians can see beyond 2 months, if they can see beyond the polls today, they look in Massachusetts and see that, wait a minute, this is something I can run on. This is a positive message I can use to deflect the attacks I'm going to get anyway. You know, I think if the members of Congress listen to that argument, if they look closely at that, I think there's a good chance they come around.
Well, now let's contemplate that the thing dies. So then the next question is, how does it start up again? I think you may see healthcare reform start up again a bit quicker than it did after Hillary Care, where we had to wait 15 years. But because industry this time around is in favor of reform. But how would that work? I mean, we're seeing, I guess, one sliver of that today is that, or rather, I should say, this week, because the president this week released his budget and it included $25 billion in Medicaid spending that was to be part of the health care bill. It wasn't the whole chunk of money, but it was a part of the money that was going to be spent under the health care bill. I suppose you could argue that, you know, the cannibalization has begun in a very small way. If we were to start over again, what is it possible for you to envision how that would go?
Yeah, I have to confess, this is sort of like one of these thoughts. I don't even want to have to go through this exercise, so I've been sort of avoiding it. It's terrible.
Well, let me at least get you to knock down what Peggy Noonan said, which she wrote a column where she said, why don't we just pass a bill saying insurers have to take all comers? She has clearly not read up on this issue. So I will allow you to answer Peggy Noonan. Why is that not the solution?
So this is the famous three-legged stool of healthcare reform, and it's sort of the thing you learn on the first day of studying healthcare policy is, why don't we just tell insurance companies to take everybody? Okay, well, because if we tell them they have to take everybody at any time, what will happen is people will say, oh, I don't have to get health insurance until I'm sick. And then they wait, they pay, then they just wait, and then they're sick, they buy health insurance, and suddenly health insurance companies, they're only serving customers with high medical costs, and they have to jack up the rates very, very high. So you want to avoid that. You want to make it possible for people to actually afford health care insurance. You have to require that everybody get health insurance. Otherwise, you have this problem with just the sick people getting insurance. But wait a minute. you can't require everybody to get health insurance because it's too expensive for lots of people. Even if you bring down the cost a little bit, you know, people making $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year are not going to be able to afford it. So if you want to require them to get health insurance, you have to give them some financial assistance. And it's those three pieces. You have to make the insurance companies take everybody. You have to make everybody get insurance, and you have to give people the money they need to afford it. And you do that, you put those three together, and I guarantee you, you're going to get a bill that looks something like the one sitting in Congress right now, because that's what they did. I will say this, you know, in terms of thinking forward, just one, I did have one idea, and I don't know how far this can go. I would not be surprised if you see healthcare advocates really focus on the states more. I mean, look, Massachusetts has gotten coverage to almost everybody, and maybe we'll see that in some of the more progressive states. You know, California has at times flirted. You know, they just one of the state houses there just passed a single payer bill again. And you know, certainly if I were a healthcare activist, if I were organizing, and I saw this happen, that's what I would do. I would start looking at states where you have a reasonable chance of doing something, and moving ahead there. And at the end of the day, most states are not going to be able to do what Massachusetts did. And obviously, it's much easier to expand coverage at the state level than it is to actually control costs. And Massachusetts, in fact, is learning that the hard way. But that is where, you know, are we going to go forward? I think that's where we'll see the energy. But that, you know, that's just a guess.
Now, there is a version of Noonan Care that was proposed, but I had a contest last week. I threw up
that's
my
right. That was a great contest. Yeah.
Slate readers, and I said, I can't figure this out. You figure it out. And I got actually some wonderful entries. The winner was someone who suggested that that Obama shove some sort of appointment down Chuck Grassley's throat to get him out of the Senate. And Iowa, where he's from, has a Democratic governor. The Democratic governor would immediately replace Grassley with a Democrat. I think there are actually about at least half a dozen states where some version of that is possible. I think that's wonderful.
I think
but
you make
of course,
a fine
that's dirty
ambassador.
Politics, and that's horse trading, and Obama's too good for that sort of thing. Another option, though, that was mentioned was a version of Noonan Care where you go ahead and do what Peggy Noonan says. You pass the bill that that tells insurance companies they have to take all comers. Then you reconcile yourself with the fact, yes, the other two legs are going to have to come, but I'm just going to sit back now and let the insurers come running, the insurers who were not in favor of health care reform now they're going to be in favor of a follow-up bill, and just sort of let that happen. And that will be the insurer's punishment for not supporting the effort the first time around. What do you think of that version of Noonan Care?
Boy, that'd be fun. I mean, I would enjoy it if that's how it worked out. I have no love for the insurance industry.
nice little industry you got there. Too bad if something were to happen to it.
I always say, I mean, there's some people in the insurance industry who actually are very progressive minded, but you know, overall, you know, yeah, I have no love for the industry. Here's the problem with that, and ask somebody in New Jersey about this, and they'll tell you, is that if you do that, I mean, there are states where they've done some version of that, where they say, all right, we're just going to require you to take everybody, you can't raise high. And the
follow-up never came in New Jersey, right?
Right, and so the insurance companies say, fine, we'll just raise everybody's rates. And so what you've done now is the insurers, I mean, they may run to Congress and say, please pass something. I mean, that, you know, that would be great if they did. But, you know, in the meantime, what's going to happen is insurance premiums will skyrocket. And
right.
So you're going to be hurting a lot of people. And, you know, and not only hurting a lot of people, which is bad as a matter of substance, but not the greatest thing to do politically. There may be, I mean, I have just not been, my head's not been in that. There may be scaled back versions of things you can do. There are. You can just expand Medicaid a lot if you want. You can have Medicare open it up and let people buy into it. But, you know, obviously these, you know, at best they're patches, and the politics tend to be a lot more tricky, I think, than people think. I mean, I know I've heard as an alternative people say, why don't we just expand Medicaid a lot? You know, I mean, a big piece of what we're proposing to do here, about half of it, is to expand Medicaid up to 150 or 133% of the poverty line. So you're including a lot more people, and that's 10 to 20 million people are getting insurance that way. Now, I'm all in favor of that. I think that's fantastic. But if you do nothing but that, that's the focus of your healthcare reform effort. Well, explain to me the political logic of spending $400 billion or something of that nature, which you're going to have to get either by raising someone's taxes or cutting, you know, making, you know, changes in Medicare that people will call a Medicare cut, and spending it only on poor people. So, you know, then you can run for office saying, great, I raised your taxes or I took money out of Medicare in order to make sure really poor people got health care. I'm all in favor of it myself personally, but, you know, good luck with that one on the stump.
Well, on that note,
on that happy note,
going for an hour. I've enjoyed talking with you, even though this has been an incredibly depressing conversation.
That's right. Well, it should be. I refuse to be. You know, in the relative scheme of things, I'm more optimistic than a lot of people, and I think, I'm going to walk away from this conversation feeling relatively good, even if, you know, the odds aren't great.
Well, that's good. I do hope that you are right and I'm wrong. I do not want to be right in my pessimism about this bill. But on that note, it was good talking to you.
Very good talking to you. And until next time.
Okay.